Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, David.
Is everyone awake and ready?
Yeah.
Wonderful. Will you please pray with me? O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master. Saints and sages of all religions. I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of thy consciousness. Amen. After such wonderful chanting, God actually expects me to stand up and say something. From Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, this is chapter 9, verse 27. In Krishna speaking, again, others, followers of the path of Jnana Yoga, offer all their sense activities and the functions of the life force as oblations in the wisdom-kindled yoga flame of inner control in self. Master's commentary. Yogis who follow the path of discrimination, Jnana Yoga, firmly picture in their consciousness within the supreme truth, the indivisible relation of soul and spirit. The Jnana Yoga yogi focuses his attention at the point between the eyebrows and concentrates his mind solely on the inner presence of the self. By wholeheartedly following this difficult path of realization, the true Jnana Yogi is eventually able to kindle the fire of inner perceptive wisdom. With this consummation, all the sense activities and the life forces from the afferent and efferent nerves, attracted by the irresistible magnetic flame of inner wisdom, plunge headlong into that sacred flame. The stanza refers to the method of God union enjoined by the Vedanta philosophy of India. The method consists in listening to the scriptural wisdom and continuously meditating on it, thereby becoming one with it, provided the mind is not pulled toward the senses by the life force and by restless subconscious thoughts. There is a difference between self-control and the fire of control in self, referred to in this stanza. Self-control often signifies the limited power of will used in subjugating a certain sense, or it may signify the power of self possessed by an average man. But the fire of self-control in self refers to the supreme and unlimited power of mastery that the self, with a capital S, possesses as a true reflection of the spirit. This reading comes from Ramana Maharshi in The Path of Knowledge by author Arthur Osborne. Siva Prakasam Pillai was one of the intellectuals among the devotees. He had taken philosophy at the university and had already pondered over the mysteries of being. In 1900, he was appointed to a post at the Revenue Department in South Arcot District. 2 years later, his work took him to Tiruvannamalai, and he heard of the young Swami on the hill. He was captivated at the very first visit and became a devotee. And he put 14 questions, and since the Swami was still maintaining silence, both questions and answers were in writing. The answer to the last question was written by the Swami on a slate and immediately copied down by Siva Prakasam. The other 13 were written out later from memory, but checked by Sri Bhagavan before being published. Siva Prakasam, referred to as SP. Swami, who am I, and how is salvation to be attained? Bhagavan. By insistent inward inquiry, who am I? You will know yourself and thereby attain salvation. SP. Who am I? The real I, or self, is not the body, nor any of the five senses, nor the five or the sense objects, nor the organs of action, nor the prana, or the breath of vital force, nor the mind, nor even the deep sleep state, where there is no cognizance of these. SP. If I am none of these, what else am I? Bhagavan. After rejecting each of these and saying, this I am not, that alone which remains is the I, and that is consciousness. SP. What is the nature of that consciousness? Bhagavan. It is Sat Chid Ananda, being, consciousness, bliss, in which there is not even the slightest trace of the I thought. This is also called Mona, or silence, or Atma, or self. That is the only thing that is. If the trinity of world, ego, and God are considered as separate entities, they are mere illusions, like the appearance of silver in mother of pearl. God, ego, and world are really Siva Swarup, the form of Siva, and the Atma Swarup, the form of spirit. How are we to realize that real, or that reality? Bhagavan, when things seen disappear, the true nature of the seer or subtle appears. Is it not possible to realize that while still seeing external things? No, because the seer and the seen are like the rope and the appearance of a serpent therein. Until you get rid of the appearance of a serpent, you cannot see that what exists is only a rope. When will external objects vanish? If the mind, which is the cause of all thoughts and activities, vanishes, external objects will also vanish. What is the nature of the mind? The mind is only thoughts. It is the form of energy. It manifests itself as the world. When the mind sinks into the self, with the capital S, then the self is realized. When the mind issues forth, the world appears and the self is not realized. How will the mind vanish? Only through inquiry, who am I? Though this inquiry is also a mental operation, it destroys all mental operations, including itself. Just as a stick with which the funeral pyre is stirred, is itself reduced to ashes after the pyre and corpse have been burnt. Isn't that wonderful? Just as the stick with which the funeral pyre is stirred and is itself reduced to ashes after the pyre and the corpses have been burnt. Only then comes realization of the self. The I thought is destroyed. Breath and other signs of vitality subside. The ego and the prana, or the breath and the vital force, have a common source. Whatever you do, do without egoism. That is, without the feeling, I am doing this. When a man reaches that state, even his own life will appear to him as the universal mother. True bhakti, or devotion, is surrender of the ego to the self. Are there other ways of destroying the mind? There is no other adequate method except self-inquiry. If the mind is lulled by other means, it stays quiet for a little and then springs up again and resumes its former activity? When will all the instincts and tendencies, the vasanas, such as that of self-preservation, be subdued in us? The more you withdraw into the self, the more these tendencies wither, and finally, they drop off. Is it really possible to root out these tendencies that have soaked up into the minds through many births? Never yield room in your mind for such doubts, but dive into self with firm resolve. If the mind is constantly directed to the self by this inquiry, it is eventually dissolved and transformed into the self. When you feel any doubt, do not try to elucidate it, but to know who it is to whom the doubt occurs. How long should one go on with this inquiry? As long as there is the least trace of tendencies in your mind to cause thoughts. So long as the enemy occupy a citadel, they will keep on making sorties. If you will kill each one as he comes out, the citadel will fall to you in the end. Similarly, each time a thought rears its head, crush it with this inquiry. To crush out all thoughts as their source is called viragya, dispassion. And so vishara, self-inquiry, continues to be necessary until the self is realized. What is required is continuous and uninterrupted remembrance of the self. Speaking today of the path of discrimination or wisdom. As God once gave me, we are involved in a fourfold path. There are four major aspects of yoga, or the way or the path toward realization. There is karma yoga. That is, when you do activities, when you are in an action, you feel that it is God who is acting through you. And you act with dispassion without any attachment for the end object for which you have begun a certain action. You're completely dispassionate. You feel it is as if God is acting through you and you are but the instrument. There is the bhakti yogi. And that one is primarily filled with love and devotion and a desire for attaining the supreme consciousness, of which God is. And then there is the Raja Yogi. And the Raja Yogi practices meditation and control of the breath and the life force until he is able to withdraw all the life energy up into the spine and to the higher regions of the brain and thereby realizes his true self. And then there is the Jnana Yogi. The Jnana Yogi is the one who uses the mind as Ramana Maharshi says, the stick that stirs the fire. It consistently goes back to the one idea in Ramana Maharshi's method of self-inquiry. Who am I? If you have a particular thought, you ask, who is it who's having this thought? If you have a particular desire, you ask it, who is it who has this desire? Now, there is something very peculiar that happens when you do this. In order to have the perspective of who is it who has this thought or this desire, creates a separation between you and that which you are looking upon. So it takes you a step back in toward the self. It takes you a step away from your identification with the senses and with the ego mind. Most people live in this life ignorant of the fact that they are something other than the thoughts, the feelings, and sensations that are constantly coursing through them. They identify with those things and they say, I am this. I am this. If you ask somebody who they are likely to tell you what their name is. But as you go deeper into realization, you realize that you have assumed many bodies. You've had many names. You've had incarnations as an entity that is less than human, you might say, and doesn't have any name at all. But purely the identification, for instance, with an animal, is what's going on in through their senses and their perception in the moment. And if you go further back and you examine yourself and your lives that you had as organic matter, such as trees, bushes, and other kinds of things, you will see that you had a sense of growth, you had a sense of perception of a sort of this world, of something cut into you, if something trampled you, you have a sensation of that. If you felt the sunshine on you, you felt that sensation. If you had gone through a long drought and suddenly there was water feeding you, you would feel a relaxation. You would feel yourself absorbing those waters. And through it, then you would feel more full and healthy and complete. Now, these are very primal kinds of impulses or thoughts or feelings, you might say, but nevertheless, they are life. And then there is what we think of as inanimate matter, rocks, mountains. These things also have consciousness. And in most cases, we have gone through incarnations also through these rocks and through these mountains. And sometimes there are very great souls that will inhabit particular parts of the earth or particular mountains. And you can feel it through your intuitive sense. You look upon a mountain or you look upon a high hill, you look upon a desert area, and you will have an experience of the being that inhabits that area. But there are also souls that are devolving, you might say, just coming into this material realm. And they will have an identification. And you can feel yourself moving through the lava. You can feel yourself solidifying. It is a very long life, and it has a very slow rhythm to it. Nevertheless, it is life. Therefore, Jesus told the Sadducees, who were asking his disciples to be quiet when they were proclaiming his Godhead, he said, "Silence all these around in their exaltation towards God, and the rocks themselves will sing out with that vibration in exaltation, in bliss." And so the very rocks themselves have consciousness. They have a self, and they have bliss. They have those qualities, but they have these sheaths that cover over, so it's not divine consciousness fully revealed in most cases. It is what we might think of as a more primitive state of consciousness. Gradually, through incarnation after incarnation, we have come to this place where we have come into a human body. Now, coming into a human being is a very interesting thing, because now, unlike many of the forms before that we have inhabited, we now have higher reasoning. And through that higher reasoning, we have greater freedom of choice. We are no longer ruled so much by instinct. We have the ability to move, to breathe, to think, to have our being. And we make decisions. Now that free will is inviolate. And so God, who we have all proceeded from, and represents the highest and most divine consciousness and awareness, stands beyond all the duality that we see around us, transcendent to all the ups and downs, the highs and lows that all creation goes through. Sometimes people refer to the inner direction or what is occurring in their life as the universe has provided this for me, or the universe has directed me in this way. But when most of us think of the universe, we don't necessarily think of it as consciousness. We don't think of it as bliss. We don't think of it as tremendous wisdom. Perhaps some have that association with it. What they're trying to do is separate themselves from the notion of God, because the name God has been so misused and abused down through history. And so we feel polarized to it. We don't want anything to do with it. And yet, the word God is the most powerful word in the English language. and to abandon it to those who will perhaps misuse it and abuse it and think of it only in the smaller terms, I think, is a very grave mistake. Rather, we should redefine it. We should refine it. We should look at it until we realize what the true truth is behind the word. Not be satisfied with fairy tales. Not be satisfied with dogmas. Not be satisfied with what we've been told necessarily. But that we should realize this is a very great thing in our lives. And not to abandon the word, but rather to redeem God's good name. Not that He needs us to redeem it, but it is beneficial for mankind if it is redeemed. So we find the true and deeper meaning behind the vibration and the word of God. Master so beautifully wrote that inwardly, silently, within his soul, unheard by any, his soul constantly hums, God, God, God. It was a love affair for Master. Now, he wasn't raised with the English language. For him, it may have been Brahm, Brahm, Brahm. It could have been other kinds of references to God. You see, the name isn't as important as the concept, of course. It's, of course. But there's a vibration that goes out when you lift something up into divine consciousness. We sang beautiful chant of Masters this morning. And one of the things he said he did with each one of the chants that came to him was that he divinized him. Now, what he meant by this is that he sang each one until they lifted him up into divine consciousness and he felt a contact with the purity of God. And in this way, the chant was divinized. It wasn't just a beautiful tune. It wasn't just sentimental or nice lyrics to it. The very thing that issued out from him, he had taken all the way to God, all the way to the Supreme Consciousness. And therefore, when others also sang it, they had that charge that came with this now divinized song. We oftentimes sing Om Shri Ram as we did today. You think of how many saints down through history have sang that tune. Now, many, many, many of them were raised up into the highest divine consciousness. And therefore, when you sing it, you are attuning and aligning yourself with all those who have raised up in consciousness to that highest elevation. And it makes the way easier for you. We can reinvent the wheel, and we can invent our own way. But you know, many times this comes from egoity. We don't want to surrender. We don't want to follow in the footsteps of another. And as a result of that, we make many, many mistakes. Now, we in the West really value our individuality and our free will. So we're constantly wanting to invent the way that is just true for us. Now, it is true. Each individual, the path that they take is for them an individuality. But there is nothing wrong with attuning and aligning yourself with those who have gone before you. In fact, it is a great thing to be able to do so. And it is good for us to be able to surrender the ego. Now, this does not mean that you become less of a human being. It does not mean that you surrender toward the ego of another person. What you surrender to is the inner divine consciousness. And when you think on Mother, or you think on Master, you think on Papa, you think on Swamiji, Swami Sri Yukteswarji, all the great ones who have proceeded before us, Ramana Maharshi, and he was one of the greats, then you are attuning yourself, if you do it with openness and sincerity and an active inner attunement, you will feel the power of the vibration that has issued forward from those individuals. Their lives have become divinized. Their entire lives have been. So when you study their lives, when you study their words, when you put your mind upon them, it is like making a direct link of an electrical current, and you feel it. You feel the power that comes from that. Now, it doesn't always come right away. With each one of the masters in our lineage, There were some that, of course, with mother was my first connection. And then the others came little by little. It came over down through the years. But there's a very interesting and powerful moment when I would feel that connection. Before, I had been thinking on the individuality. And Lari Mahasaya was the last for me. He was the most elusive for me to be able to connect with. But when I did, it's been so tremendous and so powerful, I feel his presence with me in such a terrific way. And there's the before and there's the after. The before is, it was a personality that I was thinking on, reading about. And then afterwards, it felt as if there was a direct link. Now, we must be very careful with this, because the mind can be subtle, and it can be delusive in nature. And we can feel that we are making connection and that we are getting direction and that kind of thing, and it's not really coming from the great spiritual master. And it is different than channeling. When somebody is channeling, they are not attuning their consciousness. The consciousness of the individual actually goes out of the body consciousness, and another individuality or soul comes into that mind and into that body. And sometimes they bring with them the bad habits and the bad karma associated with what they have. And so this is very, very different. We shouldn't confuse the two. Because when you attune, you keep all of your faculties. In fact, when you attune yourself properly, you feel transformed, you feel uplifted. You feel purified from the touch. And so it is a great benefit for us to do this. Now, there have been wonderful, wonderful saints all the way down through history. They have been east, they have been west, they have been north, they have been south. And for us to look with prejudice or a jaundiced eye towards any particular religion or any particular cultures, without the openness to recognizing the God experience that is systemic within each one of those great traditions. I was one time thinking about it, and I was thinking, you know, if you heard or saw a mother who lost their child through death, the grief, the tears, everything that would come forward, it would not make any difference what country, what culture, what part of the world that mother was in, you could recognize it. There wouldn't be any doubt about it. If a child is absolutely delighted and laughing and giggling, again, it would not make any difference what culture, what place that child came from. You would recognize the pure joy of that child. In the same way, when there is one who has actual God contact and God experience, it doesn't make any difference. God is not a discriminator between religions, between countries, between races. He was in all equally alike. Now, one reason that we think on and we attune ourselves towards those of India is they have made a science of this, perhaps as no other country in the world has or area of the world has. It's been tremendous, really. It's not that others don't have it. It's not that others don't have the truth. But they have really taken that truth, and they have manifested it. Now, it doesn't mean everyone who's from India is realized. Far from it. But it does mean that they have a tremendous reservoir, not only of saints, but of wisdom. Now, we find those same truths right within our Christian tradition. We find it within the Sufis, within the Muslim tradition. We find it in Judaism, and we can read it in the great masters of old of Judaism. We should listen with that inner intuitive knowingness. Now, when you begin to separate out yourself from your thoughts, your feelings, your sensations, now you live a life differently in this jnani state. You still have thoughts. You still have feelings. You still have emotions, but they don't touch the inner core of who you are. They pass right on through. And it's not even that you don't have particular likes and dislikes or preferences. But again, none of them touch the inner core. You, in your true self, stand free from all of these things. And so you have feelings, and they pass through you. You have thoughts, they pass through you. But you have more than thoughts and feelings. You have intuition. And now you are guided by a higher intelligence and a higher power, and that begins to move through you. And you feel that you are the instrument. And as the self, you are watching this all occur through you. And it feels like a play that is occurring. So you have all the experiences of a human being. And yet you are transformed. You are different. You have that sense of separation. And you have that sense of purity of self deep within you. And it is never touched by any of your earthly experiences. Now, when you can come to that place and you're stable in that consciousness, you have really attained something. You are now a realized being. You are a Jiva Mukta. You are freed while living. Now, you may attain that state and still you may have some karma come your way. You are not yet complete in the sense that there's the law of cause and effect, and things still have to be worked out in and through you. But you are a dispassionate observer of what is occurring. And eventually and finally, you come to that place where there is nothing at all left in the balance books. You are completely free. You are now a paramukta. You are now supremely free. And now you can go exactly as divine consciousness. You and divine consciousness have become one. Now, many religions today, that would be regarded as complete heresy. And even in many of those religions, where it is held up as a high virtue, if any individual comes along and proclaims it for themselves, they are looked at with a great deal of skepticism, to the point where it is doubted whether anybody really can attain to that supreme consciousness. So you hold the ideal out, but you don't really believe it. And so there are many barriers, obstacles, towards this complete realization as you strive to go beyond it. But you must go beyond the opinions of others. You see, if you're concerned and overly concerned and identified with those concerns about what others are thinking, you're not there yet. There are those who come to this path. And for instance, one who came and was very devoted and following along, and they became involved with another Kriyavan romantically. And then at some point that romance grew sour, and for some reason they grew afraid. It's not that the other individual ever did anything wrong to them, but they grew afraid of this other individual, to the point where they didn't want to come to meditation services anymore. And then they started trying to talk to others and say, well, you're afraid to leave the services. You're afraid to leave these teachings. You see, it's a wonderful thing that the mind does. It begins to project onto other people what itself is feeling. Ego is a wonderful thing, isn't it? And it's powerful, and we can see it from a distance, and we go, why in the world would anybody get caught in that? But when you're in the middle of it yourself, it feels very real to you. Now, Lari Mahasya used to discourage any kind of philosophical conversation, particularly with those people who are not practicing. Those people who are not sincerely going deeper and trying to get beyond the things of the ego and diving deeper into meditation, of what use is philosophical conversation? In the beginning, it's all right because you're learning to orient your mind. But after a while, it's completely useless and it's a sidetrack. The only place of wisdom cannot be found in the manas mind. It must be taken to the buddhi, or that discrimination that the yani has illumined within themselves. And now the truth stands revealed before you. And you cannot convince somebody who's in a state of ignorance of the truth in any absolute kind of a way. Because that truth can only be known when you have fully realized it yourself through your own direct experience with God. No amount of mental calculation will get you there. And so you see some people try to get it, because they're not willing to make the effort. They don't have the courage to go deeper themselves. And so there are many who get stuck on the mental plane because they're not going deeper. And it's a constant restlessness of the mind. It is never satisfied, no matter how much is read, no matter how much is studied, because there's no direct realization. We must use discrimination, you see, on the way up to the best of our ability. And one of the ways to use discrimination is to know the qualities of what God consciousness is in the way that it's been described to us by the great saints and masters. God is all love, all light, all joy, all bliss, all perfection, purity, the true state of being, the true state of reality. And until we attain in and within our own beings, within our own self, to those qualities, we've not arrived yet. And if we haven't arrived, then we must push further. We must go deeper and soar higher. And we should not rest satisfied. You see, it's a temptation along the way that a certain kind of inertia takes over, and we want to rest where we're at. We want to be okay, and if we're not having any tremendous pain in our life, if we're not having any threats, if we're not, things are going kind of all right, we can get complacent. But this is deathly, deathly to our spiritual practice. We must constantly hold out before us what these attributes of the divine are, so that we can compare and contrast, and when we find ourselves falling short, then that is a signal to go further. Go further. Striving, striving, behold, one day the goal, as Lari Mahasya used to encourage the disciples. You climb, you climb, you climb, and you keep climbing until you get to the ultimate peak. There are false peaks that come along the way. But if you really look around, you'll always see that there's a higher peak. It's not until you get to the pinnacle that you look around and you see there's nothing higher. You stand in the rarefied airs. Your vision is unobscured by anything else that's around you. And when you are able to enter into that highest and most divine state and retain yourself in that state, then you have achieved that wonderful state of Sahaja Samadhi. Now, there's one thing that Ramana Maharshi said in here, that there is no other ways in order to erase the mind. Now, one thing that must be understood is that every master comes with an aspect of the path that they embody. And so you will see where Papa will say that the bhakti and the repeating the Ramnam is the highest and best way. Master will say that Kriya is the highest and best way. Ramana Maharshi will say, Bini Jnani is the highest and best way. And from their own perspectives, they're bringing out a truth. But it's not the ultimate truth, and that is the only way. But you see, he's speaking to those who have gathered around him. These are things that have been written and distributed around the world since that time. But he's speaking to those, and he's speaking to them in a very specific way. This is your way. And you follow this way. And as I say, we follow the fourfold path. And so there are aspects of jnani. Definitely, we have to use discrimination. We have to learn to use the mind well in order to separate out which is God and what is not God. Now, the mind cannot say what God is. It can only discriminate about what God is not. So as Ramakrishna summed it up, he says, jnani says, not this, not that. And you keep sorting out what is God not. Anything that can be alive, anything that can be born and then die, is not God. Anything that can come and go, anything that has a high and a low, is not the ultimate God. It can have no duality to it, you see. It can have no duality to it. So you, as a spiritual scientist, set your mind upon the highest, most tremendous, supreme goal known to mankind. And you go beyond the beyond. You go into that absolute nirvikalpa. You go into the highest. And then, as you continue to become purified When you come back down into normal consciousness, you see that it is divinity everywhere, beyond creation and right embedded within creation as well. This is the most beautiful, the most wonderful, the most exciting path you can possibly imagine. And it is the most direct path. There is not a lot of formalism. There is not a lot of ritualism. There is not a lot that goes along in that way, because the whole intention, as Mother said, is to keep your mind on God. There's no organization. There are no board of directors or committees. There's nothing charged for what you receive. It is given freely. And all that is expected is that you sincerely apply what you have been given, and then give back freely, as God directs you to give, to all this world. We have a new edition of the Cross and Lotus Journal, and I've included something that God gave me, and I feel like Papa when he was patting himself on the back and said how well Ram Dass had done. When you feel things come through you, it's an odd sense, because you know that these thoughts have formed themselves within your mind, and yet you feel it's come from some source that's so far beyond you that you can stand back and look at it with some appreciation. And that's certainly how I see this, and it is the truth. And it's entitled, Come. My dear Master, when you say with such love, I will come again and yet again, to save all souls from pain of separation, I hear a clarion call to all of us, to come. Come, my brethren. Come and bring your dear ones nigh. One devotee takes the hand of the next. That one stretches out and takes another by his hand. And so on goes the chain. It is a chain of humanity, a chain of love. Come, my brothers and sisters, come. Come into the universal kingdom of soul, where the light illumines every mind, where love is the only bond. Come to where wisdom sets the bearing, and selfless service is the singular motive. Hear the Master's call, my dear ones. Hear his call, echoing through eternity. And come. Come out of your darkness into the warm light of self-realization until none are left in the dungeon of delusion. So let us heed the call that Master gave, that he would not rest satisfied until all beings, all souls, had attained the divine beatific vision that he had. Now, a humorous side note is, once he was speaking to Mother, and he said that he had once said that, and he says, my God, I must have been crazy for saying that. That he would continue to ply the boat between the shores of the world and eternity until there were none left here. But in Buddhism, that is called the Bodhisattva's vow. And it is compassion and love for all humanity, for all creation. You know, when you experience this joy and bliss within yourself, this peace, you want it for everybody. You want it for everyone. For everyone. Not just one or two or here and there. But you know how deeply satisfying, how transformative it would be for all beings to experience this. And so you want that for everyone. And yet, for some reason, in God's own keeping, he's made it difficult to communicate that experience, to inspire, to uplift others in order to come into that experience. But really, all mankind would be tremendously surprised and delighted by knowing the truth of their real being. And yet, the vast majority of humanity today enjoys playing in the play, in the lila. And they don't want to be called in quite yet. They're having fun, and even when they complain about the rules or who did what to who, they're very involved in the play. They want to see it through as they think about it in that way. Without realizing, as Mother said, that God is life and life is God. And when you're in business with God, you're in business with all of life. So the ego mind makes God realization seem like separation. Isn't that interesting? It makes it feel like if I became God realized, I'd be separate from this world. I'd be separate from the ones who I love. And yet we know that it's not true, and yet the feeling is there. It keeps us from diving deep and soaring high. So let us practice this wisdom and discrimination. Realize these delusions as they come. And separate ourselves from all such ideas until we stand preeminent to all thought, all feeling, all emotion, all sensation. And we stand free. Stand free. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. I feel the wonder and the beauty. Of thy glorious presence. In every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Out of the light within you all.